On July 28, 1945, a woman named Betty Lou Oliver survived a 75-story elevator fall in New York City. To this day, it remains the world record for the longest survived elevator fall. On the same day, at the same location, the New York City Fire Department brought a raging fire under control between the 78th and 80th floors of a skyscraper in just 40 minutes. To this day, it remains the world record for the highest structural fire to be brought under control by firefighters. Also on this day, at the same location, was the cause of these two world records, and so much more in terms of tragedy and destruction. A B-25 bomber slammed into New York City's Empire State Building. Welcome to Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. I'm your host, Dave Gorham. I've created this podcast series to bring you interesting but tragic stories of airplane crashes from across the United States and from around the world. Today's episode, When the B-25 Bomber Crashed into the Empire State Building, is about how dense fog and perhaps pilot stubbornness led a seasoned combat pilot to not only fly his B-25 Mitchell bomber into the world's tallest building, but also how it caused the loss of 14 lives, both on board the airplane and inside the building, as well as millions of dollars worth of damage. It was Saturday morning, July 28, 1945, in New York City. There were low clouds across Manhattan, and pockets of drizzle and fog were scattered across the tri-state region of New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey. Because it was the weekend, traffic on the streets and on the sidewalks of the Big Apple was light. The buildings were mostly empty of the Monday through Friday workers, but the city was not empty. Despite the weather, it was prime tourist season, and on any day of the week, including weekends, there are plenty of people moving about in one of the busiest cities in the world. Despite the weather, it was a happy day in New York. The war in Europe had ended just 10 weeks before, and the Yankees had won the day before. And even though the war in the Pacific was still raging on, all things considered, New Yorkers had a lot to be happy about. One of those happy people, or at least relatively happy people, was Lieutenant Colonel William Bill Smith. Colonel Smith was almost 200 miles away near Boston, but he was happy. He was happy because he was no longer flying combat missions over Germany, and he had been spending a few days with his wife and infant son. And on this day, he had easy and routine duty. Fly a B-25 Mitchell bomber, nicknamed Old John Feather Merchant, from Hanscom Field just outside Boston, not too far away from the New Hampshire border, to Newark Army Airfield in New Jersey, just west of New York City. Today's flight was to pick up his boss, Colonel H.E. Bogner, then fly back to their home base at Sioux Falls Army Airfield in South Dakota, the Army airfield that today is known as the Sioux Falls Regional Airport. It would be about an hour or so to Newark, and then about 5 or 6 hours over to Sioux Falls, and nobody would be shooting at him or his boss. Though this was a routine flight for this young, seasoned veteran, Colonel Smith was concerned about fog. There was fog at Hanscom Field, and there was fog at Newark, and plenty of low clouds and rain along the way. He had even mentioned his concern for the weather to his wife before departing for the airport. But wait, Lieutenant Colonel Smith was just 27 years old, yet he is already a seasoned veteran? Yes, that's very true. Bill Smith was born in Latham, Alabama in 1918. By 1942, at the age of 24, he had graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Just a few months before he graduated, Japan had attacked Pearl Harbor, so Bill was activated immediately upon graduation and sent to Europe. In Europe, Bill's talent as a pilot was evident. He amassed 500 combat hours in an astounding 100 missions over Europe as co-pilot, lead pilot, and then aircraft commander of the 457th Bomber Group. The 457th flew the giant B-17 Flying Fortress, but as the war in Europe was winding down, the 457th was retooling to fly the new B-29 Super Fortress, and it seemed likely that a deployment to the war in the Pacific was on the near horizon. Typically, the B-17 was manned by a crew of 10, including pilot, co-pilot, navigator, radio operator, bombardier, and gunners. Those early B-17 crews needed to complete 25 missions to fulfill their tour of duty and be sent back to the States. And with the survival rate of those crews being less than 50%, it must have seemed like quite the long shot to survive 25 missions. Toward the end of the war, as the resistance from the Axis forces and the overall risks to the air crews became less, the number of those missions climbed from 25 to 30, and then to 35 missions. But still, even though the risk was less, manning a B-17 in the skies over Europe was a very dangerous job. Consider that in just 14 months, the 457th lost 83 Flying Fortresses, each with a crew of 10. With so many losses to his fellow airmen, it's remarkable that Bill survived 25 missions. But he returned to the skies over Europe over and over again until he reached 100 missions, an absolutely amazing accomplishment. Before his tour of duty was finally complete and he headed home, he had been promoted to Air Group Commander and had been awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross with Cluster, meaning it had been awarded twice, and the Air Medal also with Clusters. So yes, it's fair to say that this young man, just 27 years old, was a seasoned veteran behind the controls of an airplane. That said, on this day, it was just the second time Colonel Smith was piloting a B-25. The flight to New Jersey may have been routine, but Colonel Smith had his eyes to the sky. New Yorkers interviewed later recalled it was quite the dreary July day across the tri-state, and conditions were deteriorating through the mid-morning hours. But a dreary day won't stop many pilots from taking off. Fog, on the other hand, will. Most pilots, if not all pilots, can or will become disoriented in fog, or in the dark, or flying through clouds. Unable to see the horizon or landmarks, what is up and what is down become uncertain, while assumed straight and level flight can veer unwittingly to the left or the right, or climb or descend, all while the pilot is unaware of what is happening, and, perhaps because of the disorientation, unable to take the corrective proper actions. This is why all commercial pilots, and really all but the most casual of pilots, take instrument flight training and become what is called instrument rated. This means that a pilot's visibility during training is restricted, so that only the aircraft's instruments can be seen. Sometimes called being under the hood, this training may have been in a flight simulator with a blacked-out canopy, like the Link trainer that was used extensively during the war to train pilots, or perhaps it was in an actual aircraft in flight with an instructor pilot beside the trainee pilot. This important aspect of training teaches the pilot to fly the instruments, and only the instruments, for determining all aspects of flight without relying on any indicators from the outside world. This not only enables the pilot to stay on course, but to return to the proper course and attitude quickly should a course correction be needed. Without a doubt, Colonel Smith spent many hours of his flight training under the hood. It was standard training procedure. Despite this staple of pilot training, early bombing missions of World War II were restricted to daytime raids specifically for the advantage of the improved visibility for targeting that the bright sun would bring. But later in the war, a new invention called radar changed the character of these missions. With radar, pilots were now able to see into the darkness, as well as the clouds, and bomber raids were now directed into weather conditions previously unheard of, and night missions too, black, moonless night missions that not only restricted the pilot's ability to see, but the ability of the enemy trying to hunt down and destroy the B-17 raiders. With so many of Colonel Smith's assignments coming later in the war, it's likely that he was very familiar with flying limited visibility outside the cockpit, but it's not certain that he used or was familiar with using radar to assist his visibility. With so many missions under his belt, and considering his medals and fast promotions, it's probable that he was flying the newest and best aircraft, including the ones with radar, but there's no indication of that. And although many B-17s flew night missions and relied on radar, not all B-17s were so equipped. Many of the large bombing missions used a technique much like follow the leader, where a few planes with radar led the way for many others without. The new radar technology of World War II changed the tactics over Europe, and not just in the air, but on the sea for targeting, and even in meteorology, where U.S. Army Air Force meteorologists were some of the first users of radar to locate and track storms. For the early B-25s coming off the production line, it was rare to be fitted with radar, though it became more common after 1944. However, starting in 1943, the Navy and the Marine Corps versions of the B-25, the PBJ, had success mounting radar units in the bottom gun turret, and then later versions of the Mitchell had radar mounted under the nose or under the starboard wing. The Army Air Force's C and D variants had radar installed under the nose, but these radar units were quite rare, and since the C and D models also brought other improvements like de-icing and anti-icing equipment plus upgraded guns, it was more likely than not that a C or D model would not have radar. Widespread use of radar in the B-25s came with the J variant, and most of those were used to locate enemy ships in the Pacific by the Marine Corps. The B-25 that Colonel Smith was flying on this day was a D variant, indicating radar was on board, but I think we can only say today that radar may have been on board, but probably wasn't. However, whether it was on board or not, these radar units were not integrated into the pilot's line of sight, and it required a separate operator. Since Colonel Smith was the only pilot, and the only other member of the flight crew was the crew chief, Sergeant Dmitrovich, the radar scope, if it was there, sat unused. And taking this line of thought just a little bit farther, even if the radar scope was in the hands of a skilled operator, at that low altitude and below the skyscrapers of New York City, that scope would have been, in the words of my friend and B-25 pilot Larry Gregory, lit up like a Christmas tree. In other words, almost useless. So, what exactly happened and what went wrong for Colonel Smith, the other men aboard the old John Feather Merchant, and those tending to business or sightseeing in the Empire State Building? It's too easy and almost unbelievable to say that this highly skilled and seasoned combat pilot became disoriented in the fog, but that appears to be what happened. First, though, let's get a check on the proper definition of fog. Fog is a ground-based phenomena. If it's not on the ground, it's not fog, it's a cloud. And clouds can be very low, but if the cloud is on the ground, then it's fog. And since Colonel Smith was at about 1,000 feet above the ground when the plane struck the Empire State Building, and since people on the street could clearly look up to see the plane roar by, it was apparent that Colonel Smith was not in fog, but in a dense, or actually just below a dense layer of cloud. In radio conversations with air traffic controllers at New York's LaGuardia Airport, where the cloud ceiling was reported at 1,500 feet, or 457 meters, Colonel Smith was told by the controllers that they were not able to see the top of the Empire State Building, implying that they could see the lower portions of the building under the cloud ceiling, but not the upper portions. From LaGuardia, it's 6 miles or about 9.5 kilometers in a straight line to the Empire State Building. The building was an obvious landmark and visibility marker, which would be very easy to see without fog. Had there been dense fog, the controllers couldn't have seen any portion of the super skyscraper, or, of course, if there was fog, or if it was less dense, the building would be partially obscured. Either way, if the controllers at LaGuardia could see a building 6 miles away, even the world's tallest building, the visibility was pretty decent. And speaking of definitions, let's define a cloud ceiling. A ceiling is the height above ground of the lowest cloud base below 20,000 feet that is covering more than half of the sky. Weather reports will indicate a ceiling by calling it broken or overcast. Broken signifying that more than half of the sky, but not all of the sky, is covered by clouds. While overcast indicates that all of the sky is covered by clouds. For instance, a weather report relayed to a pilot might say that there is a broken ceiling at 1,200 feet and overcast at 2,000 feet, or broken at 365 meters and overcast at 610 meters. This would indicate to the pilot that there are some breaks in the clouds at 1,200 feet, but the cloud deck is solid at 2,000 feet. These determinations are made by professional weather observers at the airport or measuring devices along or near the runway, such as solometers using projectors or laser light. Balloons can also be used to determine cloud height as the balloon is launched and then timed as it ascends into the clouds. Control tower operators can provide cloud height information, and so too can pilots who can relay the information as they either ascend into or descend out of the clouds. Like so many industries, many humans have been replaced by machines, and this is very true at the airport. Whereas human weather observers were once quite common at military and civilian airport facilities, the human weather observer is quite rare today. Most cloud height and ceiling determinations at airports are made using solometers. Let's get back to Colonel Smith. He's in Massachusetts. He needs to pick up his boss in New Jersey. He has to then fly to South Dakota. He's got fog and low clouds along his flight, and now he's looking at a likely delay in his departure. Due to the many airplanes already in the air between Boston and New York City, and because all the air traffic is being slowed due to the weather, his desired 10 a.m. arrival time in New Jersey would now be delayed until noon. Picking up his boss 2 hours late wasn't going to work, so he searched for an alternate solution. The solution he found was to route his plane to LaGuardia Airport, where the ceiling and visibility was better, then hope for a way to push over to Newark when the weather conditions improved, or try to go even if the conditions didn't improve, but didn't deteriorate either. Let me take this opportunity to say that today's LaGuardia Airport, on the north shore of Long Island just outside of New York City, was known at the time as the New York Municipal Airport, before the name was officially changed to LaGuardia Airport in 1947. The airport name was changed to honor then-mayor of New York City, Fiorello LaGuardia, who had championed the airport in its early days. The story goes that before the airport was built, Mayor LaGuardia grabbed headlines when he landed in New Jersey at the only airport serving New York City at the time, Newark Airport. But his ticket oddly proclaimed that he had arrived in New York. This infuriated the New York City mayor, and he urged his fellow New Yorkers to support a new New York City airport, one actually on New York soil. The move to construct a new airport to serve the city began shortly thereafter. If you've flown into LaGuardia, you know it is a somewhat harrowing approach from the northeast. Planes fly low over the East River, and because runway 22 juts well out into the river, the passenger's perspective makes it appear as if the plane will land on the water until the last possible moment when the wheels finally touch down on terra firma. Plane spotters will enjoy the view from Citi Field during a Mets game, as it appears the planes are landing or taking off just on the other side of the outfield fence. Now, I mentioned the cloud ceiling at Newark Airport. It was reported as 600 feet with fog by the controllers and meteorologists, but this proved to be a matter of contention. During the war, Newark Airport was controlled by the Army, and it didn't return to commercial use until 1946. But this 600-foot ceiling was reported by civilians. The Army, on the other hand, reported that the ceiling was 1,000 feet, also with visibility somewhat restricted by fog. Colonel Smith was recommended to land by the civilian tower controllers at LaGuardia, not Newark. However, Colonel Smith chose to rely on the Army weather information rather than the civilian weather information, and he made the fateful decision to land at Newark. Today, it's about an hour's flight from Boston to Newark for the typical commercial airliner. In 1945, a modern, state-of-the-art bomber like the B-25, it might have been about the same, although an Army Air Force's plane did not have to follow the same air traffic control procedures and routing directives as civilian airplanes in those days. The B-25's maximum altitude was 24,000 feet, or about 7,300 meters, but that required oxygen masks for the crew as the cabin was not pressurized. The Feather Merchant was likely staying below 10,000 feet so that the three men on board didn't have to wear oxygen masks, and with a maximum speed of about 230 miles per hour from its two radial engines, this short flight with heavy clouds along the way probably saw an airspeed no higher than about 180 miles per hour. Despite the lower speed and the low clouds, Colonel Smith had reached Western Long Island in good time, just less than an hour. As the weather deteriorated, Colonel Smith descended below the clouds, but knew if the ceiling dropped below 1,000 feet, his flight would have to be terminated at the nearest airport. As he neared his destination, the ceiling dropped to 800 feet, and controllers requested that Colonel Smith land his plane immediately. Instead, Colonel Smith requested permission to continue to Newark, This request was granted by the civilian controllers, but with the caveat that Colonel Smith returned to LaGuardia if the ceiling or visibility decreased. Over New York City, flight rules required a minimum altitude of 2,000 feet, or 610 meters. This would allow aircraft to clear all the buildings of Manhattan with a wide margin to spare, including a margin of more than 500 feet over the Empire State Building. Except by this time, Colonel Smith had become lost in the low clouds and reduced visibility and thought he was already over Manhattan, when in fact, he was east of Manhattan over Walfare Island, a small island in the East River. Thinking he was on course for Newark Airport and without the tallest buildings of Manhattan lying in his way, Colonel Smith descended below the cloud deck, but instead of looking at the clear horizon of New Jersey, he found himself in his B-25 roaring down 42nd Street. Here's a sound clip of a B-25 performing a low-level flyover at an air show. For the people of 42nd Street, the bomber sounded very similar to this, although likely louder, as the sound from the 28 cylinders and 3,400 horsepower from the two radial engines echoed and reverberated off the buildings on either side of the Feather Merchant. The seasoned combat pilot had likely been in more than a few tricky situations in his B-17 over Europe, but nothing like this. He was forced to quickly turn to avoid the 1,000-foot-tall Chrysler Building, where, based on accounts from the street and from inside the windows of buildings he flew past, the Feather Merchant was about 300 feet or perhaps a bit higher. From the Chrysler Building to the Empire State Building, it's 11 blocks south and 3 blocks west. By foot, that's a 10 or 12-minute walk. In a cab at rush hour, you might feel you would never get there, but it would be merely a couple of seconds, if that, at 175 or 180 miles per hour. Yet, turning to avoid the Chrysler Building sealed the fate of the old John Feather Merchant. Though Colonel Smith pulled up on the controls and did his best to avoid the impact, the turn away from the Chrysler Building put the bomber on a direct course for the world's tallest building. It was impossible to miss, and he slammed into the building between the 79th and 80th floors. The B-25 Mitchell bomber is a very good and very capable plane. It entered military service in 1941. This was the year before then-Cadet Smith graduated from West Point. If you're up on your World War II history, then you'll remember that it was the B-25 that flew off the deck of the aircraft carrier the USS Hornet. It was actually 16 B-25s that launched off the deck of the Hornet in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Japan in an operation that is known as the Doolittle Raid. The B-25 was still a new aircraft at the time of the raid, but World War II saw rapid development of aircraft in a very short period of time. Remember, at the beginning of World War II, some armies still relied on horses for transportation, and some of the airplanes first used in the war were the biplanes made famous by the barnstormers of the 1920s and the 1930s. By the end of the war, the mighty B-29 Superfortress was in the sky, and jet aircraft were signaling a new beginning for aviation. All told, nearly 10,000 B-25s were produced during the war. The B-25 was not unique in that it went from a paper design to flying in the war in about 2 years, but it did require a major wing redesign, which slowed production significantly. The old John Feather Merchant was originally an Army Air Force's trainer flying out of Randolph Field in San Antonio, but just a month before this fateful day in New York City, the Feather Merchant had been transferred to Cincinnati and converted to a VIP transport plane. Comparatively, the B-25 is a significantly smaller airplane than the four-engined B-17 Flying Fortress that Colonel Smith was more accustomed to flying. The wingspan of the B-25 was shorter than the B-17, about 36 feet shorter, or about 11 meters shorter. Its empty weight was about 16,000 pounds less than the B-17, and its maximum speed was just a little bit less than the larger four-engine plane, but the two-engine B-25 Mitchell was more nimble and responsive to a pilot's inputs at the controls. Maybe calling the B-25 a sporty SUV compared to the lumbering 18-wheeler of the B-17 would be an easy-to-visualize analogy today. It was a good design, it worked well during the war, And after the war, many B-25s went into commercial service, and some even became early versions of what we know now today as the corporate jet, winging high-powered executives around the country, though with radial piston engines, of course, not the jet engines of today's corporate transports. Dwight D. Eisenhower used a B-25 as his personal transport. And unlike most aircraft from World War II, quite a few, about 100 Mitchells, survive in museums, and about 45 B-25s are still in airworthy condition today and can be seen flying at air shows around the world. One of the largest post-war gatherings of the B-25 was more than 50 years ago for the 1970 film Catch-22. The movie brought together not only the many B-25 Mitchells still in service at the time, but the many men who formed the crews to fly and maintain the World War II bombers for the movie were the same ones who flew the plane in the war some 25 years before. Of the nearly 13,000 B-17s that were produced, only 9 are in airworthy condition today. And this includes the latest information following the tragedy in Texas when the B-17 known as the Texas Raiders crashed to the ground following a collision with a P-63 as this podcast was being produced. In addition to the crew of the B-25 and the bomber itself, the third member of this unfortunate and tragic accident is the Empire State Building and the people within. Just a few inches shy of 1,454 feet, or 443 meters, the first 85 floors of the building are used for office space and other commercial use. The 86th floor is an observatory, and then above the 86th is the spire, which is used primarily for mechanical purposes. The spire is then topped with a second observatory on the 102nd floor, and then all of that is topped by the 203-foot pinnacle, which is covered by multiple broadcast and other antennas, and of course, a lightning rod tops it all, as the super skyscraper is hit, on average, 25 times per year by lightning. It should be noted that there were no residential apartments at the time of construction, and that remains the case today. Construction of the Empire State Building began in March of 1930, and remarkably, was then open for business just 15 months later, in May of 1931. Once completed, the new addition to the New York City skyline was officially recognized as the tallest building in the world, a title it held until 1967, when Japan's Austin Kino building took the title. Interestingly, during the last year holding its title, in 1966, another construction project just 3 miles away had begun. And when it was completed in 1970, this building, the North Tower of the World Trade Center, would take the title as the world's tallest building. Today, the tallest building in the world is in Dubai, the Burj Khalifa Tower, which measures 2,717 feet, or 828 meters. That's more than 1,200 feet, or about 366 meters taller than the Empire State Building. In fact, that's just about 18 stories short of two Empire State Buildings, standing one on top of the other. Today, the Empire State Building is ranked as the 54th tallest building in the world. Yet, despite taller buildings in America, and even in New York City, the Empire State Building has come to represent the city and America to visitors from around the world, and even to native New Yorkers and recent residents alike. Perhaps not surprisingly, it's been called America's favorite building and has been named one of the 7 wonders of the modern world and as one of the 7 wonders of modern engineering. Iconic images of the Empire State Building have adorned countless magazine covers, and the building has been featured in books, TV shows, documentaries, and in some of the biggest Hollywood movies, like King Kong and Independence Day. There are even a few movies not about New York, but about New York's dark alternate identity, Gotham City, home to the Dark Crusader, Batman. But everybody knows this is actually New York, complete with the iconic skyline that may or may not include one of the most recognizable buildings in the world. Of course, there are many other statistics and factoids about the Empire State Building that I'll save for another time, but this one is hard to believe. The Empire State Building boasts a mooring mast for docking would-be transatlantic airships of the era. These airships, known as dirigibles or blimps, would dock at the mast, disembark passengers via a gangplank that would actually be the highest gangplank in the world, attached to the tallest part of the tallest building in the world, and then a high-speed elevator would whisk them to the street. The whole process would take just a few minutes. A few terrifying minutes, I would think. Though the plan for the airship docking was considered plausible, it was the disembarking of passengers that proved, if you will, a bridge too far, and the plan was scrapped. However, in September of 1931, one privately owned dirigible did indeed dock at the mast. It was windy, and the ship managed the docking for just 3 minutes, but it happened. 2 weeks later, right out of the book entitled Never Let a Good Idea Die Before Its Time, a proof-of-concept undertaking saw the Goodyear blimp Columbia lower a bundle of newspapers to a man on the Empire State Building's tower. And though this mission was actually successful, no other dirigibles attempted to dock or deliver cargo to the building ever again. The mast structure adds 200 feet to the Empire State Building's flat roof and is responsible for the building's record height, and it remains in place today. Even with all of that, the world's tallest building wasn't an immediate success. Despite already being iconic, thanks in large part to an oversized gorilla dangling the imperiled and impossibly tiny woman from the top of the building, investors were not impressed, not by the gorilla, and not by the building. The building wasn't even profitable until after World War II, some 15 years after its construction. Some even called it the empty state building due to its disappointing lack of occupancy in those initial years. In the early 1950s, it was considered cheap real estate. However, by 1961, the tide had turned, and the building was on the rise to success with an occupancy rate of nearly 100%. Since then, it has weathered a number of economic downturns, although it's proving difficult to weather the landscape of the post-pandemic economy today. Only time will tell, but offices around the country and around the world are downsizing and emptying. New York City is no different, and the effects are hitting the Empire State Building in a supersized way. Consider, too, that tourism during the pandemic came to a crashing halt around the world, and tourism accounts for a large part of the Empire State Building's annual revenue. According to the latest figures, the revenue generated by the observatory nearly matches that of the office leases. In 2019, that accounted for 38% of the building's overall revenue. Thanks to the pandemic, observatory revenue was down 77% in 2020. Tourism is returning, and observatory revenue has been up the past 2 years in 2021 and 2022, so hopefully that trend continues and the building can return to the pre-pandemic levels of tourism. Given its history, iconic status, and the view from the observation decks, I would think it should recover fully in the very near future, if it hasn't already. When Colonel Smith's B-25 slammed into the north side of the Empire State Building, the plane, of course, was torn apart. Burning fuel poured down the side of the building as well as down elevator shafts and stairwells. A nearly 20 by 20 foot, or about a 37 square meter hole had been ripped open in the outer wall. The 79th floor was set ablaze. One engine careened through the building, punched out the other side, and crashed down onto a 12-story building across the street where the resulting fire destroyed the penthouse studio atop the building. The other engine punched its way through office walls to an elevator shaft where it fell 1,000 feet, or about 305 meters, to the sub-basement. Sandwiched between the engine and the sub-basement floor was an elevator car that, fortunately, was empty of passengers. Meanwhile, the port side wing of the airplane was sheared from the fuselage and it sailed down to Madison Avenue, more than a block away. Killed on the Mitchell bomber, in addition to Lieutenant Colonel Smith, was 30-year-old Army Air Force's Technical Sergeant Christopher Dmitrovich. Though sitting in the co-pilot's seat, Sergeant Dmitrovich was not fulfilling any duty as the co-pilot on this flight. During World War II, there was a program that graduated more than 2,500 enlisted men as sergeant pilots, so it can't be stated that only officers fulfilled pilot or co-pilot duties, but Sergeant Dmitrovich was not in such a position. The available records indicate he was a gunner early in the war, but was listed as crew chief for this aircraft when he left Sioux Falls on the old John Feather Merchant with Colonel Smith just 2 days before. His role assisting Colonel Smith on the flight deck of the bomber, if he did, is not known. The sergeant, just a year before, had been shot down over Holland while crewing a C-47 troop carrier. He was then captured by the Germans, but was able to escape from captivity and return to the Allies shortly after. Also on board the Mitchell was naval aviation mechanic and New Yorker, Petty Officer 2nd Class Albert Perna. Petty Officer Perna was not part of the crew on this flight, but was instead simply hitching a ride home to visit his family in Brooklyn. As it happened, the family home was just 8 miles from the Empire State Building. And as if his death wasn't enough for the Perna family, Perna's brother Anthony had died just 11 weeks before when the destroyer he was serving on, the USS Luce, that's L-U-C-E, was attacked and sunk by Japanese kamikaze aircraft in the Pacific Ocean, about 20 miles southwest of Okinawa Island, Japan. The other deaths from the crash of the B-25 on this dreary New York day included Paul Deering, who was a public relations volunteer working for the Catholic War Relief Office on the 79th floor. He died when, while trying to escape the rushing flames, he either leapt from a window or the force of the crash knocked him out of a window. He died when he landed on the balcony 5 stories below. The Catholic War Relief Office had 20 women working this Saturday, all of whom were burned, many severely. 8 of these women would eventually succumb to their wounds. Another man, a janitor on the 78th floor, was trapped where he was working and was consumed by the fire. Joe Fountain, injured while working on the 79th floor, succumbed to his burns a few days later. All told, 11 office workers and the 3 men on the old John Feather Merchant were killed and 26 more were injured. Although on a normal business day, upwards of 15,000 people may occupy the building, on this Saturday it's estimated that only 1,500 were in the building. This number is especially relevant when considering the weather. On the observation deck, the cool temperatures, low clouds, and fog very likely deterred visitors. When pleasant weather prevails, upwards of 10,000 people per week would visit the observatory, where visibility could reach more than 80 miles in any direction. Not only could visitors see New York and New Jersey, but on a clear day, the view could stretch as far away as Delaware to the south, Pennsylvania to the west, and Connecticut and Massachusetts to the northeast. Had it been a glorious July Saturday, the observatories would have likely have been packed, and the streets below would have likely been teeming with sightseers and shoppers on their way to any number of stores or shops in this Midtown Manhattan neighborhood. The increased street traffic would have likely slowed the rapid response of the New York City Fire Department as well. This day wasn't all about the tragedy. There was also heroism. Frank Powell, who was the manager of the tower atop the observatory, was able to lead those from the observation deck safely down a fireproof stairway. Arthur Palmer and his assistant, DJ Norden, worked for the Caterpillar Tractor Company on the 80th floor. The two were able to assist a badly burned elevator operator. They found a hammer, used it to break through a wall to escape the advancing fire, and then after climbing through the hole and then through an empty office, they entered a hallway which led them to a stairway, and they then descended 30 stories until they found a makeshift aid station. Meanwhile, bounding up the stairs was Army veteran Harold Smith. Smith was on the 62nd floor when he felt the building shudder with the crash, and he raced up to the 79th floor just ahead of the firefighters from the city's Engine Company 54. The response from the fire department was remarkable. Engine Company 54 is located near Radio City Music Hall. Even with the lights and sirens, that's at least a 6 or 7 minute drive, coupled with a run up many flights of stairs. It's reported that some firemen used the still working elevators to quickly reach the 78th and 79th floors, but many firemen did not have that luxury. There are more than 73 elevators in the Empire State Building, and by design, many of them only go as high as the middle floors, but many of the lower elevators were undamaged, and firefighters used them as they could, and then some were able to transfer to the elevators that would reach the upper floors. As a safety note here, I will state that in the event of a fire, building occupants are always supposed to use the stairs, not the elevators, when evacuating a building on fire or one that is suspected of being on fire. There was also teenager Herbert Fabian. He took an unattended elevator. Remember, elevators in large buildings of the day always had elevator operators. So he took the elevator up from the lobby and rescued 20 people who were trapped between the 30th and 40th floors. And then there was Coast Guardsman Donald Maloney, perhaps the hero of all the heroes on this day. Like Herbert Fabian, Donald was also a teenager. However, at 17 years old, he was already in the Coast Guard and had been in pharmacist training in Connecticut. But on this Saturday, he was in the city on furlough, and in uniform, he witnessed the crash from the street. And so he ran into a nearby drugstore and demanded morphine while the clerk handed him the largest first aid kit they had. Maloney then followed firefighters to the basement, where they cut a hole in the wall to the elevator shaft. The firemen urged the small teen to crawl through the hole to the fallen elevator. The apprentice pharmacist mate became the first to reach the fallen and significantly injured elevator operator, Betty Lou Oliver. But Maloney wasn't done. After assisting in the basement, he then began climbing floors, checking every stairwell on the way up for injured or stuck people. At the 70th floor, he encountered three injured people and he carried each of them down, one at a time, to the 67th floor for additional safety and for treatment by the medics. He then continued up to the 79th floor to help the firemen and others with the grim and dangerous tasks that still needed to be accomplished. For his actions of heroism, New York City Mayor LaGuardia awarded Maloney with a citation. The Navy awarded him with the Navy Commendation Medal, and he was cited for saving the lives of at least a dozen people. After World War II, Maloney transferred to the Navy and served as a combat medic during the Korean War. Let's close this podcast with an answer to the question that many of you may be wondering. Why didn't the Empire State Building collapse when it was struck by the B-25, similar to the way the Twin Towers collapsed on September 11, 2001? There are several reasons for this, but the primary reason is that the fire caused by the B-25 Mitchell bomber did not burn as hot or for as long as the fires caused by the crashing of the hijacked Boeing 767 airliners on 9/11. Though the structural steel of the Twin Towers was built to withstand 200 mile-per-hour winds and even a traditional building fire, the structures could simply not withstand the tremendous and prolonged burning of the jet fuel, which basically melted the support of the towers. The 767s, having taken off from nearby locations on the East Coast, were loaded with hours of fuel as they were bound for California. Colonel Smith's plane had very little fuel left on board, as it was just a few minutes from the end of its journey in New Jersey. Newark Airport was just 16 miles away. It was the uncontrollable fire and the way it impacted the structural steel that brought down the Twin Towers. And while significant, the damage to the Empire State Building was comparatively minor, and the fire was contained in just 40 minutes. Though some floors remained closed for quite some time for repairs, the building itself was open for business Monday morning, less than 48 hours after the Saturday morning crash. Per the building code of New York City, the Empire State Building, like all buildings in New York, was built specifically to withstand an airplane crash. And it did. But what was it on this day that caused Lieutenant Colonel Bill Smith to become disoriented in the clouds and lose his way over Manhattan? By all accounts, the weather was a known issue that he was aware of. Even as he walked to his aircraft early Saturday morning in Massachusetts, he knew what he was flying into. He had the training and experience to overcome this situation. How did it get the better of him? And why did he not have a designated co-pilot for this flight? Why did he disregard the advice from the controllers at LaGuardia to land at the Long Island Airport instead of at the Newark Airport, where the weather conditions were worse? It seems Colonel Smith gave the nod to the Army weather report over the civilian weather information, but shouldn't safety and prudence win out in a situation like this? Was it that he was picking up his boss and didn't want to be late? Any executive traveling today knows that weather can be an issue, but high-ranking military officers in wartime can add a little bit of pressure to their pilots, and by little bit, I mean a significant amount of pressure. Maybe it was hubris that kept Lieutenant Colonel Smith from landing at LaGuardia. With more than 100 combat missions over Europe, it's easy to suspect this. There's an old saying among pilots that says, "There are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old, bold pilots." Was Colonel Smith being too much of a bold pilot? In 1945, black box flight recorders were still 8 or 9 years away, so we'll never know what happened or what was said in the cockpit of the old John Feather Merchant in the moments before the B-25 bomber crashed into the Empire State Building. That's all for this time on Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. Thanks for listening. With each new episode of Radar Contact Lost, I will bring you interesting but tragic stories of airplane crashes from the United States and from around the world. When these crashes involve the weather as a possible cause or contributing factor, I rely on my 40-year career as an Air Force, broadcast, and commercial meteorologist with a specialty of aviation meteorology to explain what happened and why. If you like this episode, like and leave a review and tell your friends. On Instagram, follow @RadarContactLostPodcast. I'm Dave Gorham.